Hello and welcome back to Talk Evidence, your periodic look at the world of evidence brought to you by two evidence nerds. That's me, Helen McDonald, Integrity Editor at BMJ, and Juan Franco, Editor-in-Chief of BMJ EBM, that stands for Evidence-Based Medicine, and also a GP. Hi, Juan.
Hello, back from hibernation.
Regular listeners will know it has been a rather sparse offering from the world of evidence so far in 2024, and this is our first episode of the year after an unplanned break. We are going to catch you up on a couple of things that you may have missed, and we are going to return to our usual monthly podcast schedule. So, on with this episode. First up, a GLP-1 receptor agonist and the wonder drug semaglutide. What might its role be in helping us to manage obesity? Juan and I will hear from two special guests to give us their perspectives as a GP and as a person with relevant experience. We'll talk about the Diagnostic Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM-5, and take a deep dive into the evidence about who's making it. And finally, Juan and I take a trip down memory lane, today's when we were hospital doctors, to discuss a paper on in-hospital cardiac arrest, how long it lasts, and how likely you are to live and leave hospital in a reasonable cognitive state afterwards. Let's start with semaglutide, a glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist. I spoke with James Cave, Editor-in-Chief of Drug and Therapeutic Bulletin, and a GP about the latest evidence evaluating the benefits and harms of the use of this drug to manage obesity in the absence of diabetes. And Juan spoke with Lenny Bull Christensen, who has personal and professional experience of obesity. And there's been some new evidence emerging from the SELECT trial on semaglutide that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November 2023. And the Drug and Therapeutic Bulletin covered a summary of that study and also carried a review piece on that. So that's why I was interested to begin with James and what he might be able to tell us about this drug. James, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Well, to set the scene, I was debating whether we should start with the evidence or you. So let's start with you. You're a GP. So tell me a bit about, in your clinical practice, how you encounter this drug at the moment, what your feelings are towards it.
I think as a GP, it's more talk rather than action. And a lot of talk about it. People are asking about it. And a lot of people are very interested in asking if this the answer to my problems. I think, though, the moment it's not being used very much for a number of reasons. I think the whole landscape of non-insulin dependent diabetes for GPs is fascinating because we've gone through a period of incredible complexity. We've had some really sort of interesting drugs come out in the last probably decade or perhaps even a bit longer now, and they've not been very good, if I'm honest. You know, the glitter zones and the old-fashioned sulfonylureas, they all had problems, and we are quite reliant on metformin, which was licensed, I mean, it must be about 40 or 50 years ago. And actually what's happening, and this is why semaglutide is interesting, is we're now getting a couple of drugs. We've got the so-called Flozins, and now the GLP-1 receptors, which is what semaglutide is an agonist for, which are actually making significant inroads on the management of diabetes. They seem to work not just at lowering people's blood sugars, but also improving outcomes. And the other great advantage of them is they don't cause weight gain, which is a lot of the old drugs used to. It's in fact quite the opposite. As we know, semaglutide, as Wegovy, as the brand Wegovy, has been now licensed for the management of weight in patients with risk factors.
And not so, necessarily diabetes.
And not necessarily. That's the interesting thing. So initially as Ozempic, it was licensed for the management of type 2 diabetes, either on its own or with metformin. And then more recently, it's gained this license for the management of weight. And of course, this is why the drug company that makes it is now the biggest company in value in Europe. I mean, it's just clear that with such a high level of obesity in the Western world, this drug is going to be in high demand.
Mm. So tell us, with your editor-in-chief of the DTB hat on, what you make of the evidence that you're seeing that's emerging around the drug.
Well, with regard to diabetes, the evidence is clear that it seems to reduce HbA1c very effectively, probably as effectively, if not more so, than most of the other drugs we have, bar insulin. It also seems to be good at being cardioprotective, so people seem to have less heart attacks and strokes who take it. And in fact, in the US and in Europe, the guidance suggests that we should be using these drugs first line in patients who either have cardiovascular disease or at high risk. We don't in the UK at the moment, but that's what the US and European guidance is suggesting. Nye says we should only use them if they've got obesity in that situation. So that's the diabetes. So that's good. The issue here is the weight evidence. And the problem with weight evidence
in the absence of diabetes.
Exactly. So this is patients who want to take it because they're obese. And let's be honest, a lot of these patients are at risk of diabetes. And therefore, it seems like a good idea. But the problem with weight treatment is it, like any other drug that's ever been trialled, ever, looking back at the old-fashioned amphetamines that we used, and oh, there was that awful drug that basically meant that you didn't absorb fat, so you just became slightly incontinent. It was an awful drug, and patients very quickly recognised they could just stop taking it. But every drug that's ever been licensed for the management of obesity only works for as long as you take the drug. And therefore, the issue here is, what are we achieving by saying to someone who's overweight, here's the problem, you just need to take this drug and you won't be obese anymore. And the problem is, if you look at the studies, and we haven't got many, but we've certainly got one study that's gone on, I think, for 2 years, where they had semaglutide for 1 year and then they were followed up for two. Most patients put back on the weight. It's not going to be the drug that's important in the long term, it'll be the lifestyle. And we know this from Roy Taylor's work. So Roy Taylor is a consultant up in Newcastle who did work on non-insulin dependent diabetes. And he did these very low calorie diet studies where he got patients who were at risk of diabetes or who'd been diagnosed with diabetes and got them to go on a 800 calorie a day diet for 12 weeks. They lost anything up, you know, more than 15 kilos in some cases. And what he demonstrated was that if you then give people the right sort of support after that 12 weeks, many more of them will not regain that weight.
Do you think there are further evidence needs with respect to how the trials are designed or run? I mean, you seem to be describing in a way that these studies perhaps should be run more as part of a complex intervention where you're perhaps giving this drug for a certain time period in combination with other psychological or exercise support or within the context of a broader program that helps you to make changes to your life overall.
Well, yes. I mean, I think one of the most difficult problems for government or anyone trying to sort this out is, at the moment, you can get a box, call it a drug, put a label on it. You've got an incredibly good system to dish this out to people. It's called, you know, dispensing and prescribing. It's very slick. It's very organized. And, you know, it'll cost £30. Now, if you try and organise a programme that delivers exercise or lifestyle care to people, trying to package that up into a little box and make it cost you £30 is really difficult. So it does require sort of incredible change in the landscape. It requires, I think, you know, a real change in how we look at food, how expensive food is. You know, how can it be that a burger can cost you less than an apple? You know, that just doesn't make any sense. And yet that's the sort of environment a lot of people live in. And if we don't deal with that, then all we're going to end up doing is giving all these people who can't afford the apple a drug to try and reduce the weight they're gaining from their burger. and it just makes no sense at all. These are better than a lot of drugs we've had for diabetes. It does seem to be effective in reducing people's weight whilst they're on it. But is it, you know, is this going to be cost effective in the long run? That's the big question. And do we want to go down that road? Do we want to go down the road of saying obesity is a disease, we just need to treat it with drugs?
Juan, I'm really interested next to hear more from the lady who you spoke with. Should we do that and then we'll talk a bit together about what we've heard?
Yeah, sure. I think that a lot of the themes that James covered are inevitably interlinked or intertwined, whatever the word is, with what Lena will bring in the interview.
Perfect.
My name is Lene Bull Christiansen. I'm a Danish fat studies researcher. I work at the University in Roskilde in Denmark. I'm also fat myself. I also have a lot of experience with dieting and living in the world as a fat person.
So perhaps some people will hear and might be a little bit shocked with the word fat. Could you explain a little bit about why you're choosing to use fat?
I use it as very much as a discursive strategy, actually. We have all been quite used to, for example, hearing the word gay, but only 50 years ago, it was a slur, right? So I use the word fat to try and remove the stigma from that word and use it as a neutral signifier. But I do know that a lot of people don't really like hearing that word and would be offended if someone called them fat. So it's not a straightforward thing to do.
Certainly it'd be difficult for physicians to start using, right?
Right, yeah. That is difficult. I think that a good way to go would be to talk about high weight, for example, rather than using the words obesity or overweight, which can feel very stigmatizing for a lot of people. We should remember that when people are fat, there's actually really no good cure for that. That dieting is actually not a viable path to permanent weight loss. And there are really no pathways to permanent weight loss. And also remembering that being on calorie restriction, which you will be both with surgery and with medical interventions, is not something that is good for you. It will trigger a lot of emergency responses in your body to be on calorie restriction. And it does affect your metabolism in the long term, being on a diet. So there are a lot of consequences to your health associated with dieting. So those things combined lead me to think that we need to actually think quite differently about weight and about fatness in order to help people who are fat to have better health. Trying to make people who are fat thin has not given any good results over the last, 100 years that we have tried to intervene in people's bodies in that way.
But you've led me directly into the paradigm, right? Now we have this new drug that have boomed last year, I would say. One of the largest studies published recently, the SELECT trial, indicated that after 2 years, there was a 10% reduction in weight compared to 1% in the placebo group. So that's sort of, a lot of people would say that is sort of a change in paradigm, in the sense of that you mentioned that there's no pathway for sustained weight loss. But what happens if those drugs are as a new pathway? What are your initial thoughts about that?
Well, my initial thoughts are that, firstly, I would love to wait and see 10 years if people can actually sustain their weight loss with these drugs, because what the drug does is help you to be on a diet. So people will have to be on a diet while being on these drugs, and also feeling all of the problematic effects of dieting while being on the drugs. So all of the problems associated with a low calorie intake will of course also apply to this group of people.
I haven't thought of that. Yeah, it is true that they will presumably eat less, and that we don't have the data on what happens with the quality of the diet. There's another study that was published in JAMA about a similar drug, tirzepatide, that said that after 1 year of interruption of the drug, people who interrupted the drug had a 14% regain of the weight. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience of weight regain?
Well, studies that look at how people experience dieting and yo-yo weight.
Could you explain what yo-yo weight is for those who don't know?
Yo-yo weight is the experience of losing weight and then gaining it and losing it and gaining it. So the weight going up and down like a yo-yo, basically. It is something that can be described as a traumatic experience, because you have put a huge amount of effort, of time, money, and just mental power into having your weight loss, and then slowly but surely experiencing that your body simply will not sustain the lower weight, and that you feel utterly out of control is quite traumatic. And that combined with the social and cultural condemnation of people who are fat and people who gain weight is something which is quite hard, because you do feel a lot of shame associated with that experience.
You mentioned the weight stigma of fat people, right? But we've also seen media and social media, they talk about the Ozempic face, which is, it's not very clear whether the drug causes or not, but the particular loss in fat in the face, which would be a sign that people are taking the drug. What do you think about that in the context of stigma, of how people look in terms of their weight?
I think that it ties in with the very popular idea that losing weight is easy, right? So taking the drug is for people who are lazy, because they can't even be bothered to do the healthy thing, which is just to eat well and exercise, right? And so taking the drug is seen as an easy or lazy choice, which for most people who want to go on this drug, certainly it isn't. Most people who go on this drug would have lost a lot of weight many times, will have dieted extensively many times and regained the weight. And knowing how hard it is to sustain a weight loss has then decided that they will also carry the quite heavy expense of going on this weight loss drug. So I would not put any stigma on people who take this this way out, because it's not easy to live as a fat person in our society. That being said, I would wish that people didn't feel the need to do so.
Juan, what did you learn by listening to James and Lena there?
Well, they both highlight the need to understand what happens at the long term, and that these drugs are only may only be effective while people are using them, and it is expected a weight regain if we stop them, like the history of drugs. And I think that having heard that from James, as an authority figure in pharmacology, you know, it's interesting to contrast with the patient experience of saying how difficult it is to be in long term always on the process of being in diet, and of incredible work, and that puts on people with high weight, and the frustration of weight regain. So and that led me back to the interview with James, where he mentioned the concerns of problems in related to mental health, in saying, could it be that in the long term we need to be very mindful of the impact on mental health, perhaps directly related to the drug? I don't know about that, but not only about the drug, but all these constant pressure of always keeping your weight low with this drug, and what your habits and caloric restriction can, in which ways that can influence your life. So I guess it led me wondering a lot about what is the true role for the management of obesity.
When I was talking to James, I was quite struck that it's quite problematic in some ways to look at a weight loss drug in isolation, isn't it? Without thinking about what might be around that the healthcare facilities might be providing, or that the patient's going to have to be doing for themselves at home, and thinking about what are the outcomes at the end of that? How long should a study be? What should the outcomes be? Is it weight loss? Is it the absence of other weight-related health measures? Is it about well-being? I think it raised so many interesting questions that took us far away from the flashy study that we started with in NAJM, which triggered us thinking that we should cover this item. So we'll include the links to the flashy study in the New England Journal, and to DTB's article. And big thanks to James and to Lena for talking to us about their professional and personal experiences. We're on familiar territory for Talk Evidence, I feel, with our next item. We're on to undisclosed financial conflicts of interest as relate to DSM-5-TR and a cross-sectional study that featured in the BMJ. And it was interesting hearing about Lina's experience with weight, and how those conditions are kind of described and constructed in our social system. And Lauren Davis, Lisa Cosgrove and colleagues' paper talks about the people and forces at play behind the way that DSM-5-TR was constructed. And that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which is published by the American Psychiatric Association. And it kind of standardizes symptoms and defines psychiatric disorders. And so it's very central in terms of playing a role in the care for people who have experienced psychological and mental health symptoms. And it's also really important for approving psychiatric drugs. And this is the third time that Lisa has been involved in investigating the degree to which the pharmaceutical industry has had a seat at the table defining what mental health symptoms are linked to disorders, and investigating undisclosed conflicts of interest amongst those panel members. Lisa was interviewed by Duncan Jarvis recently, so you'll hear his voice on the podcast as she explains what has changed or not changed over the years.
Well, starting with our first study that was published in 2006, we found that almost 60% of the authors of the DSM had financial associations with industry. And then when we replicated that study in 2012, we found approximately the same percent. And then now with the DSM-5-TR, we found that 60% of the authors who met inclusion criteria had ties to pharmaceutical companies.
When you started this, did you expect any authors to have financial conflicts of interest?
I thought maybe some, but I was quite surprised at the percentage of members who had industry ties. And just to clarify that for people that might wonder, why should this matter? Unlike other diagnostic manuals, there aren't any biomarkers for any of the disorders in the DSM. There's no blood test or scanning technique, for example, that could determine if a person has bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. And so that makes this manual, I think, more vulnerable to industry influence. The way in which industry influence can exert itself is through implicit bias, encouraging what some researchers have called pro-industry habits of thought. What that means specifically for the DSM is that this pro-industry way of thinking lends itself to a medicalized view, medicalizing emotional distress. And I think a good example of that would be the new disorder in the DSM-5 was binge eating disorder. And one of the main treatments promoted and FDA approved to quote unquote treat binge eating disorder was Vyvanse, which is a psychostimulant. And it's interesting that the manufacturer of Vyvanse, the patent was about to expire, and once a pharmaceutical company has a new indication, they get extra years of exclusivity, meaning that they can still charge a higher price. The drug won't go generic. So I think that's another example of the way in which you see the quote-unquote false positive problem, or what we could refer to more commonly as overdiagnosis, being exploited by drug companies.
How important is the DSM, really, do you think?
Well, it's often referred to as the Bible, quote-unquote, of psychiatric disorders. And the reason for this is because it's used by all mental health professionals, at least in the United States and other countries, as well as researchers. In the United States, it's tied, of course, to reimbursement. But the categories are also used to design medication or medical device trials. So the manual has a wide-ranging reach internationally, clinically, and in terms of research. And I would add to that, it also, because DSM categories have entered into our cultural discourse, it also has a far-ranging reach in terms of how people understand themselves and their experiences. You know, 50 years ago, ADHD was not part of our cultural vocabulary, or bipolar disorder, or even major depressive disorder. And today, many people around the globe not only are familiar with those terms, but use those terms to describe their experiences.
So that was quite a clear message from Lisa there, that these conflicts of interest are not acceptable, and we've really known about that for some time. And for those people who aren't familiar with it, IOM, which is now known as the National Academy of Medicine, or NAM, is one of the three academies that make up the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine in the United States. And in 2009, they produced this landmark report on standards for trustworthy guidance. And that's what Lisa was referring to there as she was talking to us. Juan, what did you think of that piece?
If you think about some of the concepts that we usually hear at the Preventive Overdiagnosis Conference, which is similar sort of to this concept of vertical integration in manufacturing.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, vertical integration is when when a company controls all the supply chain from the creation of the, for instance, in media, it has to do that they control the production of media, but also the commercialization and the stream and the distribution via streaming, and then the advertising. So it's and that concept has been compared to healthcare in the influence of the pharmaceutical industry in controlling the definition of diagnosis, because the definition of diagnosis would allow to adjust generally expanding the number of people diagnosed with the condition and are susceptible to receiving new pharmaceutical treatments. So and if they're influencing the guidelines at the diagnosis level, and not only in the treatment level, then they can increase their basis for prescription quite widely. And it's sad, especially for mental health conditions, by which we already know that we are in a global crisis of lack of resources for people with mental health disorders, that the expansion of definitions is probably benefiting more these expanded indications than actually helping the people that are suffering the most.
Okay, so our final paper this episode is Survival After In-Hospital Cardiac Arrest and Cardiopulmonary Resuscitation, or CPR, as I will refer to it here on as. So the research question here that was being studied was, based on the minutes of CPR delivered, what is the likelihood of being alive at hospital discharge and having reasonable brain functioning? So this is a little overview of the study. So this is a US study conducted using data from patients in hospital that contribute to the Get With The Guidelines Resuscitation QI, so Quality Improvement Database. And they included patients who were over 18 with a cardiac arrest, who didn't have a no resuscitation order, and then went on to receive some amount of CPR between the year 2000 and 2021. And without going into great detail, the database is sufficiently good to mean that they can come up with some credible answer. So they look at cardiac arrest, which they define as pulselessness requiring chest compressions, defibrillation, or both. And it's the minutes between the start of the chest compressions and the first return of spontaneous circulation or termination of resuscitation and death. And the outcome that they looked at was survival, as I mentioned, hospital discharge, and favourable brain outcome, which they have a special score, which they do that with. So results-wise, on average, amongst those patients who had return of spontaneous circulation, there was about 7 minutes of chest compressions. And on average, for those patients who died, that was terminated around 20 minutes after compressions were started. And there's a nice figure three, which goes into depicting some of that. And the paper has lots of details about splitting out shockable rhythms from non-shockable rhythms and whether the cardiac arrest was witnessed, and they chop it up by age. But I think, I mean, really the thing that comes through is the critical nature of time amongst all of that, because things start to look very, very bad, certainly beyond 20 minutes, but really, really starting to look quite bad after 10. Juan, what did you think when you read this paper? Did it take you back to being in hospital?
Yeah.
It did, and for me.
And we did this in residency. We did this ACLS course that trains advanced care support. And
advanced life support. I think that's what advanced it was called. Life support.
Yeah, and the materials that I've browsed even before this recording was that basically there's no golden rule, right? And they always talk about age, shockable rhythm, sometimes body temperature. For example, if people have hypothermia, but most physicians know that age is a huge factor, and the expectations of patients and carers and physicians of what are the chances of survival considering the clinical conditions. But I think that this paper provides very interesting, concrete information that could be used for planning and having conversations with patients, perhaps, in saying there's this whole discipline called advanced care planning, where they try to talk with patients what happens in X and Y situations. And I think that that having concrete numbers with which you can say, well, this is what you might expect if you're receive CPR for 40 minutes and you're over 80 with an unshockable rhythm, you probably it's more of an objective parameter rather than saying that the chances are slim or small, and patients will say, what is slim, what is small, you know, and this is sort of more concrete, and you can share it. And people can figure out on their own whether that's important for them, whether it's worth it. And of course, having a thorough conversation, not just throwing numbers and considering the expectations and feelings. But it is quite dismal to look at these numbers, and because you expect that with the current treatments and drugs and alert systems that we have at hospitals nowadays and devices everywhere, that the numbers would be better. But I don't think that they're better from previous studies that showed similar numbers 20 years ago. So I wonder whether there's something inherent about the phenomenon of cardiac arrest. What do you think about it?
I mean, I don't think, to that issue of time, I'm not sure that the paper split it up by years, although I could have missed that as I was reading through, because the database has been going for a while, so it was using the last 20 years or so of data. But I think that discussion that you were saying, there are some people who do want more concrete information by time. And I think it also feels quite reassuring, even just as a clinician, to think, I mean, you sometimes feel like you enter a bit of a time vortex, don't you, when you're in a CPR situation, where sometimes everything seems very long and other times it can seem incredibly compressed. And I think just having an awareness of time, being reminded of that time, obviously you get reminded every 3 minutes if you're doing cycles of CPR, but they all kind of back up together sometimes, don't they? And I think just having that awareness that really, as time passes, the odds are getting slimmer and slimmer and slimmer. So as you begin to think about what's a worthwhile intervention to be delivering, it certainly seems like if you looked at the benefit and harm of continuing or not continuing, certainly unless you've got a clear way forward, it feels like a short CPR is an effective amount of time to be delivering it for. If you've been going 20 minutes and there's not really very much going on, it seems like you've probably, in the vast majority of cases, you've run your course. So unless there's something clearly very reversible, I mean, I'm not in this field anymore, but it feels like the odds are very slim at that point. You're nodding, Juan.
Yes.
But no one can hear that.
Exactly. I'm not in the radio mode. You mentioned figure 3, which is very good. I think that figure 4 is also a little bit hopeful. If you look at shockable versus non-shockable, that the odds are, it's double the chances of with a shockable rhythm. So that sort of tells you, sometimes keep searching for that shockable rhythm, as the guidelines says. It's hopeful if we want to end up in a good note.
indeed. Well, listen, that's all we've got time for today. It's been great to be back on Talk Evidence, and we had some familiar ground treading, undisclosed conflicts of interest, emerging new treatments, are they worth it? And then we threw in that clinical one at the end for you. So I hope you found something to enjoy, and we'll be back next month. We're going to commit to this on air today, Juan, aren't we, and Duncan? We'll be back next month and resuming our regular Talk Evidence podcasts. So until then, please subscribe to us if you've been unsubscribed for us because we've been quiet for too long, and listen to us wherever you find your podcasts. But for today, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Take care out there.